Well, after a summer break, we return to our series in 2 Samuel, and we pick up again at 2 Samuel chapter 10, Folly in the Face of Friendship. And just to remind you, the last chapter that we considered, 2 Samuel chapter 9, really centered on what it was in David's kindness as he extended it to Mephibosheth, and how he took Mephibosheth from rags to riches. And we considered there that marvellous picture of grace which was well received. But here in 2 Samuel chapter 10 we have a total contrast, something totally different, in the sense of the accounts are placed alongside each other that we might see this difference. This chapter serves as a foundation for that which follows in the life of David, again marking a shift. There will be a change as he will go on to commit that adultery with Bathsheba and that which is there. But the passage itself is not just a crossover. It is not just there to form a way into the more sensational element of chapter 11. It is in itself significant with its own specific message and specific purpose. In fact, you'll find that as we read it together, you may well have noticed that it's quite abrupt in its style. It's a compressed narrative. It doesn't give us all the details as the conflicts as they take place, but it is specifically to the point it gives us on a need-to-know basis. It is abrupt, it is compressed, and it carries with it a note of crisis throughout. Crisis at different points, all the way through. There is provocation, there is reaction, there is panic, there is engagement, there is a fleeing, and then there is a quelling. And so chapter 10 brings us very much into the mindset of that which has taken place so far, and it also points us to that which is ahead. And it's interesting that both chapter 9 and chapter 10, and specifically chapter 10 in our thoughts this evening, contain an action of David in seeking to return a kindness to a son for the sake of a father. David shows regal class when he extends this kindness to Hanun. It's an overt act of tribute for a deceased leader. It is incredibly gracious considering the past between Amnon and the people of Israel. And remember, Mephibosheth is the recipient of David's kindness because he was part of the house of Saul. He was the son of Jonathan, whom David had made that oath, that promise to. And Hanun will be offered kindness because he too is a son. He is the son of Nahash, who is the late king of the Ammonites. And Mephibosheth would respond with a sense of wonder, with a sense of joy, with a sense of humble gratitude. Hanun will respond with petulance. He will respond with provocation. He will stand against the offer. He will engage in a process of conflict. And surely even there, in what I said so far, we see, don't we, those gospel principles laid out very clearly. The whole issue of man's relationship to God is brought to bear, of how God deals with man is also brought into being. God is gracious. He is long-suffering. He comes slow to anger, rich in mercy. So much that the Lord lavishes on the undeserving people. Also illustrates, does it not, the ways in which men respond to the Lord's dealings with them. Some are led to embrace the kindness of God, to rejoice in His grace, to rejoice in His mercy, whereas others will continue to stand in total rebellion against Him, against His kindness, and they engage in open conflict with Him. So I want us to consider a number of elements in this chapter together. The first thing I want you to see in verses 1 to 2 is this. I want you to see an act of compassion. David hears this news that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, had died. And David decides to offer sympathy out of compassion. And it's directed to the new king, as we have said. And why does David do this? Well, we'll come on to a little bit more of the discussion in a moment. But first and foremostly, what we know from previous narrative is this, that Nahash at some point during the years that David was on the run from Saul, showed David some kindness. We don't know the detail, we don't know the specific of what that kindness was, but we know that David received a kindness from the hand of Nahash. And so this compassion that David gives is with that very much in mind. And he brings it to bring this kindness that is there, the memory of this man who has done him good in the past. And it causes us some measure of surprise, maybe, if we did not know that, because Nahash himself was a cruel king. He was a ruthless king. He did not deserve any kindness. He was the king of a nation which was idolatrous, which was unbelieving. In fact, the Ammonites were the people, the descendants of Lot, that came from Lot's incest with his younger daughter. Genesis 19, verse 38, recalls the consequences of the tragic event. And the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the people of Ammon to this day. And you'll remember in 1 Samuel, early in Saul's reign, Nahash had sought to conquer the territory of Gilead. And he was well on the way to doing that before he had been prevented by one of the early victories for a newly crowned Saul that established Saul. And in fact, it was a crushing victory over the Ammonites at Jabesh Gilead. And so 40 years on, Nahash dies and his son and heir is on the throne, and it is to Hanun that David sends emissaries of compassion, of kindness, of diplomacy. And again, what was David's purpose? There are some who are critical of David at this point, and they say that David's motive was purely political, that ultimately he was doing this just to fulfill the diplomatic necessity, and really he was looking to carry favour and to bring about a new promise and covenant and treaty and all of those things, and that was the motive for his kindness. And indeed, in that way, it was an error. For example, A.W. Pink says that it was a great error of David to offer kindness to a nation that had been openly aggressive towards the Lord's people in the past. But I'd say we've got to be very careful there. For example, we need to remember that whilst the Lord commanded the annihilation of the Canaanites, he did give an instruction, did he not, concerning the Ammonites, to leave them alone, purely because they were descendants from Lot. Deuteronomy 2:19. And when you come near the people of Ammon, do not harass them or meddle with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the descendants of Lot as a possession. Also, there is no reason for reading David's actions as being political, as being duplicitous. He wanted to show compassion. He wanted to show kindness. And he wanted to do so for a man who had shown him kindness in his own moment of need. And that approach is worthy. That approach is wholly right. And of course, if from that relations are improved, then is that not also wise leadership? Sincerity and principle, strong foundations for leading well. And so there's no reason for us to read insincerity into David's actions here. David was prepared to do good to all, even if he was aware of the continuing principle which is highlighted in Galatians 6:10, that being especially the household of faith. And so kindness brought before his enemies is an enduring principle, and indeed one which we can heed. Did not our Lord himself teach that we should love our enemies? No good purpose can ever be served by deliberately stirring discord, by deliberately causing problem and conflict and falling out that cements prejudice, that cements animosity. No good purpose is ever achieved in that way. You know, we could even speak here of how David's approach to Hanun is an illustration of the way that the Lord's people should deal with those around them. One commentator explains here, Christ has called the church to preach the gospel to all nations. And it links in with what we were saying this morning. In the parable of the sower, the seed was sown on all sorts of ground. We cannot read the hearts of men. We cannot read the hearts of those to whom we preach Christ. but we are to be generous in our evangelistic endeavours, generous in sowing the seed and trusting in the power of the seed and the work of God to bring forth eternal fruit. David was kind to his enemies. Do you know there are many things that we can do for our enemies? Many things practically. But the kindest thing that we can do is to speak to them and bring to them into contact with the glory of the gospel, that which can save their soul. A large-hearted vision, concerned for mission, that the Lord gathers in his church by his sovereign work and power those who are called the ecclesia to theo, the called out of God. Remember also that David is that foreshadowing of Christ and of the gospel age. And in this overture of kindness, this offer of compassion to Hanun, we have the reminder that we are called as the Lord's people to reach out to a suffering, sin-sick world and to point them to the truth of a loving Saviour. Do you know there are those who might well have had sympathy with David if he'd not made any move towards Hanun? Known enemies of the kingdom. They don't deserve any kindness. We should withhold our kindness from them. But King David, even with all his faults, as we will well see in the next couple of chapters, is described in the scriptures as a man after God's own heart. And does not this glorious God reach out to the Hanuns of this world? Those who do not deserve his grace. Those who do not deserve his favour. Those who do not deserve his kindness. And what is more, does he not gloriously save such and bring them into his kingdom for eternity? It's a great challenge to us, isn't it? And very often when we're faced with our enemies, we feel that we should be anything but loving. Christ calls us to love our enemies. This act of compassion shows David showing concern for his enemy, which is there. But then look in verses 3 to 5. From that position of commendability, we see then an act of cruelty in verses 3 to 5. In the face of this kindness, in the face of this compassion, in the face of this approach, which is not deserved, we have an act of cruelty and utter folly. Do you know, any of us will testify or experience such. When an individual rejects a sincere kindness that we have sought to offer, that's incredibly painful, isn't it? Incredibly hard to deal with. Hanun rejects David's compassion and sympathy. And why does he do that? Because he listens to men around him who poison his thoughts with plots and rumours of intrigue and political advantage. You know, what was evident in the Ammonite court, you know, that can sadly take hold in families and churches too. We have to be very careful, don't we, to whom we listen. We have to be very careful what we say, and whether we are those who are good at poisoning, slandering, and maybe we use the preface which we have said and which is there and we've mentioned so many times before. Brother, I say this in love. We've got to be very careful that we need not sow such poison as these men did to Hanun, and to cause this atmosphere which was there of suspicion. And indeed, in this way, look at what they said to him in verse 3. The princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun, "Do you think that David really honours your father? Do you think he's really doing this? Do you think he's really doing this for your good? Has David not sent his servants to search the city, to spy it out, to overthrow? Isn't he doing it with an ulterior motive?" And Hanun listens to them. And he sets aside all the rules of diplomatic courtesy. He seizes David's men and he humiliates them. He shaves their beard. He exposes them in a manner that's derogatory, and it's there. And he sends them on their way. And consequently, his cruel actions will provoke the reaction that his advisers had mentioned, that clearly David did not have in his mind, but this was the honour of the people, and what is more, it was the honour of the Lord. This act of friendship is met with an act of war. This offer of peace is met with conflict. and the Lord will honour his people, and Hanun's petulance will backfire dramatically against him. Matthew Henry makes a very powerful point on these verses. This is what he says. False men are ready to think others as false as themselves. And those that bear ill will to their neighbours are resolved not to believe that their neighbours bear any good will to them. Unfounded suspicion indicates a wicked mind. One's not on this is that there is nothing so well meant, but it may be ill interpreted and is wont to be so by men who love nobody but themselves. You know, even if David had been totally perfect, I think these men still would have criticized him. Such was their attitude and such was their heart. The fact that he was a strong leader, the fact that his kingdom had grown and there was a measure of stability, the fact that David did come in some measure with imperfect reputation and yet a strong military record, concerned the Ammonites, heightened their suspicions, and it brings this cruel and foolish response. And you know, I couldn't help but think as I read that reaction, and once again another example of the reaction of the world, the overtures of the foreshadowing on a local level of what Psalm 2 speaks of. We've seen that before, haven't we, in 2 Samuel, as Hanun and later Hadadezer stir themselves up against David, God's chosen king. Does it not remind us that the world's kings, the world's rulers, are always looking to resist the sway of the Lord and his appointed messianic king? Always looking to oppose and to stand against. And again, we have these principles here that are so clear also in the New Testament concerning how the world deals with those who love and follow the Lord, how they're received in the world. Do you know, there are many who have been ambassadors for Christ who have gone, who have been wrongly accused, who have been humiliated, who have been slandered, who have been persecuted, who have even been killed for bringing the good news of the gospel to a needy people, who've gone with sincere intention, motive for the glory of God, and have been met with antagonism and anger and hatred. That is how the world responds to truth. There are those also who will not put up with sound doctrine, as Paul wrote to Timothy. So it was also the case in Old Testament times that there were those who despised the truth, those who wanted to silence those who brought any influence of the truth to them. But you know, it was always also present in Israel itself. You see, you think on the destruction of the Davidic kingdom of Judah and the summary that is brought in 2 Chronicles 36:16. This is what it says. But they mocked the messengers of God. They despised his words, scoffed at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people, till there was no remedy. Do you know, sadly, very often, Christ's ambassadors can also be mocked and scorned and persecuted within the so-called church as well. Great principles that we see laid bare. We also see the principle that we encountered this morning too. You know, when we're involved in gospel work, we have this single and clear task to proclaim the gospel in its entirety, the whole counsel of God, the message of Christ, and the Holy Spirit works in that sovereign way to bring God's purposes to pass. And so this gospel is there to preach, and ultimately there are two basic responses that result. Mephibosheth, he responded positively under the good hand of God. The approach is made to Hanun and he rejects it. By the same approach, God exalts one and abases the other. And so the gospel then becomes an aroma of Christ, which when sensed by those upon whom the Spirit of God is at work, they receive Christ by faith and he is the fragrance of life. But when sensed by those who remain in total opposition to him, the scriptures tell us that the gospel is nothing less than a smell of death. I wonder for you, as you sit here, and you've been here before, and you've heard the gospel and those things which are there, Christ crucified, risen, and glorious and now ascended and one day to return, I wonder, is the gospel a fragrance of life to you? Or is it really the smell of death? I wonder what your response is. One commentator summarizes, this means that rejection may well be a mark of faithfulness on the part of the servant of God. In other words, results do not in themselves indicate success or failure, for our calling is simple faithfulness, irrespective of the blessing God may or may not add in his sovereign good purpose. This gives some real point to the Lord's injunction that we should never tire of doing that which is right. 2 Thessalonians 3:13. You know, we need constantly to pray for grace to overcome temptations to discouragement in the face of the coldness that many have towards the gospel. We need to pray for grace, and we need to pray for grace also when our personal kindnesses offered in the name of Christ are shunned and rejected by those who are antagonistic towards them. If we plough faithfully, the Lord will have his harvest. Even those times when there is a bleakness, we must be encouraged to persevere, knowing that our labour is not in vain. The Lord is sifting men and women by his word, and when he has gathered in all he intends to redeem, his glory will be exalted in the earth. Remember, as Spurgeon said, as we quoted this morning, the cause of God is never in jeopardy. We must never lose sight of that. And so before David's men, as we return to the narrative here, before they could be further shamed by being seen in such a distressing state through all the towns and the villages, David sends messengers to them. You know, I think that's a very lovely act that David does as king. He hears of their distress and he sends messengers and he says, no, you wait in Jericho. Wait until you've regained your dignity. Wait until your beards have regrown and you can return with dignity to the capital. I think that shows a great genuine concern for his men. A concern for their dignity. Concern for their position. A leader must have a heart for his people. And so we see this act of compassion, it is met with an act of cruelty. And we see there the principle of how the world very often responds to the people of God and to the message of the gospel. And then we come to this third part, which is an act of conflict. You know, historically, when you survey the affairs of nations, you find that very often some of the most terrible tragedies have arisen from perhaps very insignificant events. Things have escalated very quickly on a minor misunderstanding. You know, Hanun must have had some inclination that the way he abused David's kind approach would not be ignored. But, you know, I actually think he thought he could get away with it. Because it then says, does it not, in verse 6, that the people come to a realization that they're now repulsive to David. Do you know, sin is very often like that, isn't it? For very often, those who enter into sin, they do so. And for a moment, it seems as though they entertain thoughts that they've got away with it. But then it becomes clear that really that is not the case. All seems to be well. And then the consequences soon set in. And so it is for Hanun. His childish effort, almost that practical joke, which obviously they thought was so amusing in the court of Hanun, now shows the true consequences, for now he faces a conflict of his own making. He is now facing the extended arm of David's forces coming in judgment against him. And again, there'll be those who criticize David here. Those who say, well, did David really need to respond with such force? Was it really necessary to preserve national honour? Was it worth it? But this act of cruelty from Hanun, however petulant it might seem, has to be looked at in its context in the theatre of nations, in the purposes of God. And as such, his act was an act of war. He takes these diplomats and he humiliates them. He deliberately sets out to humiliate the representatives of another nation before the world and to question their integrity on the world stage. And what is more, he does it to the people of God. It was a manoeuvring. It was an open act of aggression. It was an intent of war. And so they receive that for which they have jockeyed. And Hanan's reaction reveals the intent of his heart and his real disposition towards the people of God, towards the Lord, that in fact Hanan and his nation is opposed to them, that he is an enemy. It's a challenge to David's authority. And so would David just allow them to go unchecked? Would he allow his people to be treated in such a manner? Would he allow justice to go? Would this lawlessness on the border of the country be allowed to pass unchecked? Well, no. Hanan's act of cruelty provokes this act of conflict. And that is where then we move into the element of the passage and the structure of the passage, which then becomes very clipped. And we almost have a rapid element of a series of actions and circumstances. And so we see detail for preparation for war, action of war. And let me just say that this forms the background for David's sin with Bathsheba. For it is during this conflict which will stretch on, that David would fall into his sin and consequently will murder her husband Uriah in the heat of the battle at Ammon's capital. You know, I think it's right to suggest here that the author is reminding us of the strength of David's character before the David that we will see in chapters 11 to 12. I think we are being prepared so that we can see that David was indeed a strong man, but no man is perfect. And we will see that displayed. One commentator gives the overview. Here is David acting kindly, acting loyally. And there, in his sin with Bathsheba, David throws kindness and loyalty to the wind. Here is David in chapter 10, controlled by covenant, by memory, by promise, by honour. There is David in his sin with Bathsheba, driven by lust, by secrets. Here, David will spare, as the people will bow to him at the end. He will spare and he will mourn life. But in his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah, he will trample and destroy life. The contrast becomes clear. So what then are these bullet points that come in the action as it takes place? Well, the Ammonites, they begin to panic and they begin to feel nervous in facing the forces of Israel. And so they send out that they should be strengthened with 43,000 extra troops from Beth, Rahab, Zobah, Makkah and Tob, all Arameans from the north and the west of the Israelite territory. And so they bring them in to help them. The Israelites advance and they go under Joab and they advance into Ammonite territory. But then they realize that they are in the grips of a pincer movement, as it were. So the forces of the enemy are not united, they are divided. And so they have the enemy before and behind. And so in that respect, they're in a difficult position. And so the Ammonites, they are remaining outside Rabbah, their capital, and the latter, the Aramean forces, they're camped at Medeba, which is a little bit further to the south. And Joab and his forces are in the midst of this movement, this pincer movement. And so Joab tactically responds. And he moves to face the two positions by dividing his own forces. And he takes the best of the soldiers to face down the Arameans. And he leaves Abishai with the rest of the army to keep the Ammonites, at bay outside the walls of Rabbah. And depending on the way that the battle goes, they will reinforce the other. And so in that respect, they look to win the victory. I think that is a very interesting way to approach things. To have the tactical awareness in the midst of the battle, I think is a very remarkable thing. And that's what Joab plans. But then we have this remarkable verse in verse 12. In the midst of all these war preparations and manoeuvres, we then see Joab speaking with great faith and great confidence in a rousing speech. In fact, I like the Authorized Version because it speaks of playing the man. Be of good courage, play the man. But here we have, be of good courage, let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God. And this is the key point, may the Lord do what is good in his sight. That's a wonderful attitude. The cities of our God, most likely referring to the areas which the Arameans must have passed through to join up with the Ammonites, which if they lose the battle could well be in jeopardy. But let's be honest, I don't know if when you read it you felt the same as I did. Are you not surprised that Joab is able to say such a thing? Remember, this is murderous Joab. This is the one who's been looking out for himself, who wanted to be general, who is willing to take the lives of others to make sure that his own military career remained on path. This is Joab, who is willing to spill blood, hard-hearted, cause David all manner of difficulty in the cover-up and all that was necessary to pave the way and to clear the way after Joab had made that grand mistake. This is Joab. And yet here he speaks in such a manner. And what is more interesting is this, and I'm sure that you will have spotted this too. This is the only place in the entire chapter where the Lord is mentioned. This is the only place in the entire chapter where Yahweh is spoken of. And it comes from the mouth of Joab, who many of us would indeed think is an appalling man. Is that just piety under pressure? Is it just a little bit of faith because the circumstances are tough, so if we bring out the right words, it will give us courage in the day? Should we take heed of words from the mouth of such a man? Well, I would say we should. Because in this statement there is powerful truth. And that certain trust that he has in God's sovereignty shows a marked difference in emphasis in his life. And indeed, in this way, God's sovereignty is always the resting place of God's oppressed and beleaguered people. That's why we sang together, call Jehovah thy salvation, rest beneath the Almighty's shade. This is what Joab points to. John Calvin speaks of how this should be our firmest refuge in the midst of life's uncertainties. This is what he says on this specific point relating to Joab. He says, we have this point laid bare for us, which should firmly persuade us that God will never abandon us, and that in the end he will show that our hope in him was not in vain, so that our faith will not be frustrated when it rests upon his mercy and his truth. Nevertheless, he says, we must remain in suspense about many things. For instance, when we ask God for our daily bread, it is not assured that he will send us a good harvest or best vintage. We should leave that in his hands and patiently await what pleases him. When we have any illness, we must rest assured that he has not forgotten us, and that we have such access to him that in the end we will feel that he has looked on us in pity. The promise of God should be fully sufficient in regards to that. Joab's uncertainty in the outcome is not a lack of faith, for we can certainly doubt, although we embrace the promises of God and hold them as absolutely certain and infallible. What we doubt are things not clear to us. That is how the Lord wants us to remain in suspense about many things, and to leave it to his secret counsel and to his providence. What is Calvin saying there? Well, he's saying this. We should never lose trust in a sovereign, powerful God who cares and appears for his people. But there might be circumstances when the best we can say, may it be that the Lord will do what seems good to him. And when we do that, what are we saying? Well, we're saying that we trust in his sovereign purposes and his power. And we trust this, that he always works the best for his people, doesn't he? And so there are times when we do not know and are unable to see that which lies ahead, but we can have certainty in the promises of God that he is ever at work appearing for the good of his people. We can take heart from these words of Joab, providential care of God for his people. So Joab's division routs the Arameans, the Ammonites, They're persuaded when they see the battle begin to fall and they retreat into the walls of Rabbah. Joab is unprepared for a siege, and so he goes back to Israel in verse 13 to 14 and the war is placed on hold. The war doesn't go away, verses 15 to 19, because the Arameans, looking for revenge, they come to Halem near Tob to face Israel. They want to establish themselves. They want to get themselves a victory, but they end up knowing another defeat, and they are brought into subjection to Israel and to God's chosen king, to David. Matthew Henry makes the comment, it's dangerous helping those that have God against them, for when they fall, their helpers fall with them. In this case, the helpers fell first, and then the Ammonites will fall. So how are we to see these things from just history? How are we to engage with them as we come to a close? Well, we have to see them in the context of redemptive history. We shouldn't just dismiss them as skirmishes in the Near East, which always seems to have problems nearly 3,000 years ago. Again, remember the reference to Psalm 2. The opposition of the world's rulers to the clear reign of the heavenly king. You know, I think sometimes the principle is easier to apply when we think of that prayer of the Jerusalem church in Acts 4. When they applied Psalm 2 in their prayers to rulers such as Herod and Pilate. And we might think, well, surely Hanan and Hadadezer, they don't come in such a way. And we just see it as more Old Testament conflicts which just fill the pages, a prelude to the more striking and sensational account of David's sin with Bathsheba. But let us not forget that David is God's chosen king, and as such, these leaders are against him. And what is more, they lose. They are defeated. The cause of God is never in jeopardy. And we see the events of history, they are the manifestation of the workings, the purposes of God, how he is working his purposes out moment after moment. And it's true to say that such workings place into practice our understanding of the Bible, our understanding of biblical truth and doctrine. What do we see here when we come to these victories of Israel? This vindication of the Lord's cause and kingdom against the unbelief, the aggression, the rebellion of his enemies. It's central to the scriptures. The judgments of the Lord, those which are altogether right and just, they repeatedly appear across the events of time, across the events of history, and they will continue to appear. And we see in Israel's victory over the Ammonites and the Arameans shows clearly that the preservation of the honour of his name is vital as well as the integrity of his people. And friend, he sees when his people are abused. He sees when they're persecuted. He sees when they're victimised. He sees when they're oppressed. And he will visit them. That same unjust persecution and affliction which brings the believer and is used to bring them, as it says in 2 Corinthians 4, to a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory will also bring consequences for the wicked. Consequences for the wicked, the heaping of coals upon their head, bringing them into a very weighty eternal judgment. Of course, unless they turn and they repent of their sin and call upon the name of the Lord. Outside of Christ, the godless will sit besieged in their own Rabbahs of the Ammonites, fearful of the pending judgment, but unwilling to change their ways. You know, the defeat and the fall of the Ammonites, this open rebellion, petulance against God's chosen king, reminds us of the ultimate victory of the Lord. And it encourages us, but it does also challenge us if we are still in rebellion against him. I wonder if you will consider your position before a mighty and victorious Lord this night, who now approaches you with kindness. He comes to you with the glorious, gracious offer of deliverance and forgiveness. I wonder how you will respond. With petulance, with antagonism, I want nothing to do with Christ. Or will you embrace that glorious offer and kindness? You see, if you reject him now, you will know the hand of his judgment later. You see, this deliverance from sin, this friendship that is offered, is there for a season. The day of grace is at hand. But indeed, that day will come to an end, and then will come the day of judgment. David sent his diplomats and his emissaries to offer this kindness to Hanun. The Lord sends his messengers into the world to proclaim the gospel. And the response will determine the reaction. If you reject the call of the gospel in all of your sin, then you will know the Lord, but you will know him in judgment and in wrath. But if by grace you will embrace his kind offer, you will hear that inner call working upon you by the Holy Spirit of God, then you'll know his kindness. You'll know his friendship. You'll know indeed that walking submission before the King, and you'll know eternal life in that eternal kingdom. Might it be for you that you would heed the lessons of his word, that you wouldn't reject and stand in petulant opposition to the King of Kings, but that you would bow the knee, and that you would subject yourself before him, and that you would plead for his mercy and know his kindness. We're going to sing together our final hymn, 453. Arm of the Lord, awake, awake, thy power unconquerable take, thy strength put on, assert thy might, and triumph in the dreadful fight. 453.